and thanks for coming again. This talk is, yesterday I talked about building linear models, where the predictor models are linear functions of the predictor variables. Today I'm going to talk about more general models in which they're not linear, they're more general, and are based on the notion of ensemble learning. So the first few slides here basically review the first few slides of yesterday to remind you of what the problem was. We have a system under study. It has variables or attributes associated with it that have values. One of those attributes is special. We call it y, the outcome variable or the response variable. That's because we don't know its value but would like to. What we do know are the joint values of other attributes or variables associated with the system. We call those predictor variables. And our goal is to use the known joint values of the predictor variables to estimate or predict a value for the response variable. So our prediction, y hat, for the outcome y will be some function of the predictor variables, and we want a good function. And in order to define what we mean by a good function, we have to define how much errors cost us, how much we lose when the true value is y and we predict f. That has to be specified. That's not a statistical quantity at all. That has to do with the problem. You want to predict the value of y because you want to use it to make a decision. The less accurately you predict y, presumably the worse decisions you will make, and that will cost you, and that's what this is supposed to specify. As I said yesterday, generally, we don't have even though we usually have a different loss function for each problem or each class of problems, in reality, in fact, we use surrogate loss functions because we don't want to rewrite software every time we have a new problem. And the classic one in statistics is the error squared, the difference between the truth and what we predict squared. A more natural one sometimes used is this one, just the size of the error. That's when the outcome is a numerically valued quantity. When it's a binary valued quantity, then the classic loss function is that associated with logistic regression. And as I mentioned last time, support vector machines are popular, and this is the loss function that support vector machines use. Actually, any negative log likelihood gives rise to a corresponding loss function, and there are many, many more. For example, Cox proportional hazards model has its likelihood function. Multinomial regression, Poisson regression have likelihoods that correspond to a loss function, etc. Okay. Once you've specified the loss function, then the lack of quality of your predicting function is measured by what's called its prediction risk, which is the average or expected value over the joint distribution of all of the variables of the loss when you predict y with your function knowing the x's. And this is averaged over all xy values. So it's just the average loss for future prediction. This allows us to define an optimal predicting function, which is just the one that minimizes this prediction risk over all possible functions. It exists. And only if we knew it. We don't know it because we don't know the prediction risk. We don't know the prediction risk because we don't know the joint distribution of the predictor variables that we're going to see in the future, or the observations we're going to see in the future. And so in the machine learning problem, we presume we have a data set of previously solved cases. We call that the training sample. And we derive a predicting function by applying some learning procedure to that training data set. And we hope that that function will serve as a good approximation to the actual optimal predicting function, which in the machine learning literature is called the target function. It's the one that is the optimal predicting function. It will give you the smallest error. Of course, how you define the error will depend on the loss. But once you've defined the loss, then this target function will give you the lowest prediction error if you knew it. We don't know it. We have data. We apply a learning procedure to that data and hope to get a good approximation. Okay. Now, there's a lot of learning procedures. We wrote a book and maybe talked about 40 or 50, and that's a small fraction. Every issue of a statistics paper or a machine learning paper or other or engineering paper is introducing new learning procedures. Now, you might say, why are there so many? Why don't you just always use the best one? I mean, there must be a best learning procedure. The answer is there is no best learning procedure. It depends on the problem. Different problems have different best learning procedures. And that's the sad truth. There is no holy grail. Okay, so that's what we, there are a lot of learning procedures. The learning procedures I'm going to talk about today are among the most successful, not the only successful ones, but among them in the past 10 or 15 years, and they're based on the notion of ensemble learning. Okay, and here's a definition of an ensemble learner. Your predicting function is taken to be a linear combination of usually simple functions of the predictor variables. These simple functions are can be thought of as basis functions, but in the machine learning literature, they're called base learners because we not only, usually in basis functions, you pre-choose a set of basis functions and then adjust the coefficients to fit the data for your problem. Here, we're going to also try to choose the base learners separately for the problem, each problem as well. So each of these base learners is usually taken to be a parameterized function of the predictor variables. So this is a function of x characterized by a set of parameters. Specifying a joint value of the parameters specifies a particular base learner or indexes a particular base learner. When the joint values of the parameters take on all of their possible values, which I've indicated here, you define a class of functions. All of the functions that are created when the parameters take on all of the values they can take on. So the base learners that are going to appear in our predicting function are taken from this function class. Okay, and you have to specify that. So all of the ensemble learners, main ones that I know about, take this form. But there are a lot of different ensemble learning procedures, and they basically differ on the choice of function class from which they draw the base learners that go into the linear combination. Okay, they differ on how they select the particular base learners that go into this linear combination from all of those in the function class, and they differ on how they determine the coefficients of the linear combination. Now, all of the ensemble learning procedures that I know use variants of this algorithm to create the ensemble of base learners. Okay, this procedure, very simple procedure in principle, has associated with it a function that I will call the memory function. Its job is to remember the base learners are generated in sequence, as you can see, and its job is to remember information about the ones that have been previously generated when you generate new ones. Okay, so I'll call that the memory function. So if we want M, uppercase M, base learners in our ensemble, we will execute this loop M times. The main step is this one. We choose that base learner indexed by its particular joint set of parameter values. We find that base learner that when added to the current memory function minimizes the risk over the training data, that is the average loss over the training data, as evaluated on a random subset drawn from the training data. Okay, so I'll say that again. This is the main step. So this is the loss when we predict y with our current memory function plus our potential base learner. Okay. This is the risk if we were to add this particular base learner in the, indexed by this particular joint set of parameters p. We find that joint set of parameters, or equivalently, that base learner from our family of functions that when added to the current memory function minimizes the loss, the average loss or risk as evaluated on a subset of the training data of size eta, where the subset is randomly drawn differently for each iteration. You then, that becomes the next base learner in your ensemble. And then you modify the memory function by adding a scaled version of that base learner to the previous memory function. And then now we've got a different memory function. We'll get a different base learner when we go through this exercise, and that will become the next one. And we'll just keep on going until we have N of them, and that will be our ensemble. So that I will call a generic ensemble generation procedure. It has kind of two parameters associated with it, the size of the subsample and the scale parameter here. Okay, so those are the two, I call them the control parameters. They are the size of the random sample. The reason for drawing a random subsample is to increase the diversity of the ensemble methods. If you have a really large sample and you used all the data, each base learner would look awfully similar. And so this is to increase the diversity. It also reduces the computation. The purpose of the memory function, as I mentioned, is to remember what's gone on before. And when you induce a new base learner to what we would like is all these base learners to work together to make the prediction. Now, we can't look forward, since it's a sequential procedure, and take account of the base learners that we'll be using in the future, but we can look backwards and say, we want this new base learner to work with the ones we've got so far. We don't want them to be totally independent, although there are ensemble methods that make them totally independent, as I'll say in a moment. So anyway, the memory function is a scaled version of the sum of the base learners that have been induced so far. Okay, and as I said, it retains information about the previous base learners when you're trying to generate a new one that's going to work with them for to try and make predictions. And its value can be from zero. If it's zero, then nothing is remembered. Each base learner is induced totally independently of the others without knowledge that it's going to be used with them. If mu equals one, it means you're remembering the maximum information about the base learners. Okay, so let's see how various ensemble methods fit into this framework. Here's some you may have heard about. Bagging, invented by one of my heroes, Leo Bryman. Random force, also invented by Leo Bryman. The Ada Boost algorithm by Freund and Shapir. And then a variant of that that I developed. And in bagging uses squared error loss. It sets the memory parameter to zero so that each base learner is induced without any knowledge of any of the others that it's going to work with to make predictions. And it sets the size of this random subsample to half. Actually, as originally proposed, it drew a bootstrap sample, but that's in this context the same as just drawing a bootstrap sample, which is a sample of size n with replacement, is the same as a sample of size n over 2 without replacement in this context. Okay, so it basically uses half samples if you think about sampling without replacement. It sets the intercept of that linear combination of base learners to zero and sets each coefficient to 1 over the number of members. So the result is you're simply averaging the predictions of the base learners that you've induced. So you've induced a number of base learners, not knowing anything about the others, and then you will average the predictions of them in order to make your final prediction. Random force is basically the same as bagging, except it puts additional randomization into building. Random force uses decision trees as the base learner, and it puts additional randomness into building the trees, but it's basically the same as bagging. Ada Boost, which was the first successful boosting algorithm, and in some sense was one of the things that revolutionized machine learning, it was intended for a binary outcome variable. It used this rather strange-looking loss, this exponential loss criterion. It sets a memory parameter to 1, remembering the maximum amount from the past. Okay, and it sets the size of the sample at each step, the subsample, to the whole sample. So there's no random sampling. It's just that every step uses the whole sample. And it makes its predictions by the sign of the final memory function. MART, or sometimes called TreeNet, basically generalizes Ada Boost to arbitrary outcome variables, not just binary, but arbitrary, regression, multi-class classification, anything you want, and arbitrary loss functions, okay, which you have to do if you're going to have arbitrary Y. Okay, and it defaults setting the memory parameter to 0.1. It also does half sampling, like bagging, and it predicts with the value of the memory function. So those are some classic ensemble methods. They're all, you can think of them as special cases of that generic ensemble generation procedure that I described. Now, an idea that, I forgot to mention my co-author on this, and you've got it right there, is Bogdan Popescu, a former student. We proposed a simple modification to ensemble procedures that seemed to help a lot. The idea was that if you look, given the base learners, this is a linear model. You can think, if you want, of these coefficients as weights. Now, they're almost always positive, because each base learner is trying to predict y. If it's negatively correlated with y, you'd best leave it out. But basically, you can think of these as weights, okay? And the issue is, how much should you weight each of the base learners? Well, this is given the base learners, this is just a linear model. So finding these parameters is just a linear regression problem given the base learners. Once I've run that ensemble generation procedure and have the ensemble, whether it's bagging, boosting, random forest, whatever, once I have them, I can estimate the optimal way to combine them, because it's a linear regression problem. Now, just any old linear regression doesn't work very well, but it turns out that the so-called lasso linear regression problem, or any regression technique that induces sparsity, which is what I talked about yesterday, our various techniques for inducing sparsity, does work very well. So the idea is we estimate the coefficients by minimizing the prediction risk. That's this guy here, on all the data, to get plus lambda times a lasso penalty, or some other penalty that induces sparseness. I've so far only used the lasso. The parameter lambda regulates the strength of the penalty, as I discussed yesterday, and the larger it gets, the more you tend to make the absolute values of the solution coefficient smaller, and you set a lot to zero. And as we'll see, typically in these ensembles, that once we do this, we might start out with an ensemble of 500 or 1,000 members. Once we do this, the ones that survive the lasso and actually are non-zero tend to be 100. Maybe 50 to 200, something like that. So, and we improve the accuracy. And some methods, like random forest, dramatically, and other methods, like boosting, a little bit, but we get much more parsimonious models. Okay. So that was our idea, and I've never seen it make things worse. Okay. Now, almost all applications of ensemble learning, almost all implementations, take the base learners to be decision trees. Now, there's several reasons for that. You can think of a decision tree. Most people don't think of a decision tree as being a parameterized function, but indeed it is. The parameters are the splitting variables, the value subsets, the split points that define the branches, and the values assigned to the terminal nodes. Those are parameters. And you can think then of building the tree as choosing the values of those parameters, okay? Now, there are several reasons why decision trees are used. One reason is that much of this came from the machine learning community, and decision trees are outrageously popular. And so the idea is, we're improving decision trees, okay? Decision trees have incredibly desirable data mining properties. They're invariant to monotone transformations. They have elegant ways of handling missing values. They can handle all types of values, numeric, categorical, binary, circular, any kind of variable. And another reason is that of all the methods, their accuracy seems to be helped the most by using an ensemble of trees. Tends to work dramatically better than a single tree. Okay. I think it's fair to say, even now, though, single trees are probably the most popular data mining method, owing to their interpretability, which you lose a bit in ensemble methods. And there are fast approximate algorithms for finding the optimal decision tree. Finding the optimal decision tree, there are not practical algorithms, but good approximations can be got by greedy sequential strategies. Okay. Now, here's the first departure. Here I'm going to discuss, instead of using decision trees as the base learner, to use rules as the base learner. Now, rules are very, very popular in machine learning. In fact, that's why I think decision trees became popular, because decision trees, as we'll see in a moment, produce rules. And here's a formal definition of rules. Like most other things, when you try and precisely, formally define something, it makes it much more complicated than it needs to be. So I'll give the formal definition and then an example which will make it clear. Okay. Here are the predictor variables. Let J sub M, M index is the rule, be a subset of the predictor variables. It might be one of them, it might be two of them, it might be five of them, but it's a subset of them. For each of the variables in the subset, define a subset of values of that variable, of all the variables it can take. So suppose I have a subset of three variables. Okay, for each of these three variables, I'll define a subset of values. Okay, that's SJM. J index is the variable, M index is the rule. Then the base learners that we're going to be using are rules which take the form as a product over the variables in the subset that we chose of an indicator of each of those variables being in the subset that we chose for that variable. And so this is a product. This indicator function is a function of a logical argument that is one if the argument is true and false if it's not true, in case you're not familiar. So that's what this I is. So this is a product over the selected variables of an indicator that each of those selected variables is in the subset that we selected for them, each of those variables. The rule is defined by the variables we chose and the subsets of values that we chose for those chosen variables. Such a rule or function, excuse me, only has two values. It will have the value 1 if all of the variables we chose realize values in their chosen subsets. If any of them does not realize a value in the chosen subset, the rule will evaluate to 0. And we say those variables that are in the subset define the rule. Okay, that's very obtuse. Here's an example of a rule that was derived actually using the procedure I'm going to tell you about. Okay, and in this case, the data are people, the variables are demographics, and this rule is defined by three of the demographic variables. I think there were 15 or so. Okay, one of the variables is age, the other is marital status, and the other is householder status. Okay, this the subset chosen for age is 18 to 34. The subset chosen for marital status, which is a categorical variable, is either single or living together, not married. Okay, and then the subset chosen for the variable householder status was the single value rent. Okay, this rule will evaluate to 1 if the person's age is between 18 and 34 and their marital status is either single or living together, not married, and their householder status is rent. Then this rule evaluates to 1. If any of these conditions are violated, this rule will evaluate to 0. Okay? And if it does evaluate to 1, this indicates greater odds of the person visiting bars and nightclubs. That was the purpose of the exercise, was to try and predict probability people will be visiting bars and nightclubs, and this is one of the rules that emerged. Okay? Now, if we're going to have an ensemble of rules, we've got to generate rules. And so we could try to directly generate rules in our ensemble generation procedure, okay? But that would be too slow, especially if for categorical variables, because then you have combinatorial optimization problems at each step. People have proposed doing this, fast approximate algorithms for generating ensembles of rules. What we decided to do was take advantage of the fact that there are fast algorithms for building decision trees, and so on our ensemble generation procedure we'll build decision trees like everyone else, but then instead of just using those decision trees as primitives in the ensemble, we will extract all of the rules from the decision tree and use those as the elements in the ensemble. So all tree nodes, interior and terminal, will represent rules. And let me show you how that goes. I don't have enough time to explain how you build decision trees here, but here is a decision tree. A decision tree is a binary tree. Okay, associated with each node in the decision tree is one of the predictor variables. So in this node is associated with predictor variable 14, so is this node. This node is associated with predictor variable 32, etc. If the predictor variable associated with the node is numeric, Then we also associate a value of that variable called the split point with the node. If the variable that's associated with the node is categorical, then we, instead of the split point, we associate a subset of values of that categorical variable. So here, this node is characterized by variable 14 and split point U. This node is also characterized by variable 14, but a different split point, T. This node is characterized by variable 32, which is a categorical variable, and these are the three values that are associated. This is associated with variable 7 and the single value, categorical value, Z. Now, associated with each edge that connects a parent node to its two daughter nodes is an indicator function. If the node was split on a numeric variable, then the indicator of the left edge, the edge connecting the parent and the left daughter node, is just an indicator of that variable being less than or equal to the split point. The right edge is an indicator of that variable being greater than the split point. If the variable is categorical, then the edge connecting the parent to the left daughter node is just an indicator of the variable taking on one of the values in the associated subset. And the right edge is an indicator of the variable not taking values in that subset, that is, taking values in the complement set. And so we have an indicator function associated with each edge. Now, to get the rule associated with any node in this tree, you take the product of the indicator functions from the root to the node in question. So, for example, the rule associated with this node is just an indicator of x14 less than or equal to u. The rule associated with this node is an indicator of x14 less than or equal to u, x32 not in this subset, and x14 greater than t, which can be written as x14 in between t and u, and x32 not in the subset, in the complement of this subset. For node 7, the rule is an indicator x14 greater than or equal to u times an indicator of x7 equals z. So for all of these nodes, I can extract the rules, not just for the terminal nodes, but for all of the nodes. Okay? And I take all of these rules for all of the trees that were generated in the tree ensemble, put them into a big basket, and those are the variables for this giant linear regression using the lasso. Okay? And that's what I say here. All such rules derived from all of the trees will constitute the rule ensemble. Of course, the number of trees is usually pretty large, so the number of rules is quite a bit larger. And our model is now a linear combination of all of these rules, where the coefficients of the linear combination are obtained by a lasso regression of the outcome on all of these, treating all of these rules as linear variables. Okay? And because of the fact that the lasso will tend to set so many coefficients equal to zero, generally 80, most of the rules, say 80 to 90%, tend to have zero coefficients. So a small fraction of the rules actually survive. Okay. Now, if there's no law that says when you're building an ensemble that all of the base learners have to come from the same family of functions, you could take different families and make a superfamily that's your union and draw from that. Now, if you're going to do that, you're going to want to choose a second family to augment the first, such that it is good at approximating functions the first one can't. There's no point in adding another family that is not much better in approximating the functions you're interested in. Now, the hardest functions for trees and rules are linear functions. They are the nemesis of trees and rules. And so this suggests that we add the class of linear functions of our predictors as another family. So when we create all of these rules, we also put in all of the original predictor variables linearly and then run the lasso on that. So you can either draw linear variables or rules that can survive the lasso and appear. And basically what will happen is the rules will tend to describe the nonlinearities, and the linear terms will pick up the linear trends. Okay, so that's the procedure. I call it rule fit. But one of the reasons for going to rules was interpretation. Many clients are not completely friendly to black box models. They want to know, they just don't want a prediction. They want to know, why is that particular predicted value? In fact, in California, where I come from, suppose you were doing credit scoring and trying to decide whether to give someone a loan, if you deny the loan, you can't just say, sorry, my neural network or ensemble method said you were not a good risk. You have to say why, okay? And if you're a decision maker or even a statistician, you would like to know why the method is predicting as it does, as sanity checks on what's going on, you know. And so, as it turns out, generally our best predictors in terms of accuracy, this was observed by Leo Bryman many years ago, tend to be not interpretable models. Tend to be neural nets, ensemble methods, support vector machines, which are not transparent at all. They're black box models. And he said the real challenge in the future is a way to get accurate predicting models that you can understand and interpret. Okay. So the rest of this talk I'm going to discuss on how you might interpret, figure out how and why this ensemble method and other ensemble methods are predicting the way they do. Okay. So, now, this procedure that I described is a linear model. Linear models are among the most interpretable that we have in statistics, provided you can interpret the ingredients, the terms that go in it. Okay? And, of course, the linear terms are easy to interpret, and the rules are easy to interpret, provided they don't get too big and messy, and we can control that. Okay? So both rules are easy to interpret. Now, often, even if only 10% of the rules survive the lasso, that can be 100 or 200 rules. You don't want to look at 100 or 200 rules. So what you would like to do is get some measure of how important each rule is to the predictions, and then look at the most important ones. Okay, so we need a measure of how important each rule is to the predictive model. Okay, and nice thing about linear models is that they directly give you such a measure. It's the size of the coefficient times a measure of the scale of the variable. For the rule, the rules are dichotomous variables, 0-1 variables, so their scale is just the support times 1 minus support. This is just the standard deviation of that term. Okay, for the linear terms, the importance is just the value of the coefficient times some measure of the scale of the variable, like its standard deviation. These are the coefficients that you would get if you standardized all of the predictor variables to one. And that's a measure of how strong that variable is influencing the model. Okay, so that we can get for rules. Okay, now that I'm sure most of you knew. But one thing that you might not have been aware of, that linear models can give you a local importance. They can tell you how important each variable is to a particular prediction, not just averaged over all predictions, which is what I showed you before, but for each individual prediction. And basically, that is, so suppose we have a joint set of predictor values, I'll call X here, and we're going to predict the outcome for this new set of joint values of the predictor variable. And we want to know how important is each term in the model in predicting this particular value. Okay? Well, that is just the size of the coefficient of that rule times the difference between the value of that rule and its mean. Or in general, for the linear variables, it's the size of the coefficient times absolute distance of the value of that variable from the mean value of that variable. Okay? And you can see that rather obviously. Suppose when we were predicting a particular observation, X42, the 42th variable had a value that was very close to the mean of all of the 42 variables. Then you can see this is very small, this coefficient doesn't matter, and it's going to be unimportant for that prediction. But it could be very important for prediction of a different observation for which XJ, X42, was very different from the mean. Okay. So we can get a measure of how each of these rules is affecting each prediction, which is what the California law wants. They want to know why you got the value that you got. Okay? This basically measures the change in the absolute value of the function when you set the coefficient equal to zero. Obviously, if you're very close to the mean, setting this coefficient to zero is not going to change things much because this is already very near zero. But if it's far from zero, it's going to change it a lot. Okay? So if you take the average of these measures over all the observations, you get the using root mean square, you get the result that I had on the previous slide for the average influence. But we don't have to average over all the data. We can average over subsets of the data. We can say in this subset of the data, what are the important things for predicting on average? And I'll show you examples of that later. Now, one of the things that every client wants to know when you produce a model is, which are the important input variables? What I showed you before, I can get the important rules. But what about the original predictor variables, the things that were actually measured? In most data mining applications, we're operating on databases that were not constructed for the purpose of building a predictive model. They're usually transactional databases for looking up reservations, looking up inventory items, looking up bills or customers. They're transaction database. They have a wealth of information about the behavior of whatever is being cataloged. Like you can imagine the airline reservation system, if it could be mined, and maybe it is, has a lot of information about travelers' habits in it. But it's not intended to build a model to try and predict traveler habits. And so generally, a large fraction of the variables have no influence on the outcome, and generally a small fraction do. Okay, and you'd like to know what they are. Now, in a black box model, you have no idea of that. All you know is if it's making predictions, how accurate they are. Okay, you'd like to know which are the important variables and which are you might, in retrospect, not measured at all. Okay, so our philosophy in deriving the importance of the input variables is that the most important variables are those that define the most important rules. And we have a measure of importance for the rules. So the measure of how important a particular variable, say X, is for a particular prediction is the importance of its linear term plus the sum of the importances of those rules that it helps define. That's what this XJ and RK means. It means that these are the sum of the importances of those rules that this particular variable helps define, divided by, for each rule, the total number of variables that define it. So rules that are defined by more variables don't get an exaggerated importance. Okay? So again, we can get this for each and every prediction. We can average it over all predictions. We can average it over subsets of predictions. And I'll show you examples of this later, too. All right? Okay. After you tell someone about the important variables, another thing that they're often interested in are interaction effects. Is a particular variable just sort of participating by itself additively in making the prediction, or is it interacting with other variables? Does how it affects the response depend on the values of other variables? And people tend to want to know that. So I'm going to now tell you how you can get interaction effects in these black box models. All right. And in order to do that, I have to tell you about what's called partial dependence functions, which I described some years ago as an aid for looking at the dependence of functions on subsets of the variables. I mean, what we'd like to be able to do is view our function as a function of the predictor variables. Problem is, there's more than two or three. We can't do that. We can't look in the high-dimensional space. What we can do is select subsets of variables and view the dependence of the function on those subsets of variables. Like I might pick one of the variables, or the most important variables. I might pick a pair, or perhaps a triple. Okay, but of course, that's ill-posed, because how the function depends on a subset of the variables depends on the value of the other variables. Okay. But what we can do is we can ask, how does this function depend on a particular subset of the variables if we average over the other variables, get the average effects? So we want to say, how does the function depend on this subset? Okay, after we take account the average effects of the other variables. That's what we would like. Okay. And a device that does that is a partial dependence function. It's a function of the subset of the variables, and what you do is for each joint value in the subset, you take an average over those that aren't in the subset. Okay, there's about 4 or 5 pages describing and developing this in the paper. I don't expect you to completely get it right now. But the important, what I propose using these for is just to look at that. In other words, you know, take the most important variable. How does it depend on this variable? Well, that depends on the values of the other variables. Yes, Jeff? Yes. It's not how it correlates. It's interaction effects. If it's interacting with other variables, then how the outcome depends on it will depend on the values of the other variables. Correlations between the variables won't matter. It's interaction effects. It depends upon again the interaction effects. In fact, if there were no interactions, if your model was just a sum of functions, or each of those functions was a single one of the variables, right, then these partial dependence functions gives you each additive term perfectly, and it, independent of what the correlations are. Just like when you build an additive model, it doesn't matter what the correlations are, you will see here. Now, if there's highly correlated variables, those effects might not be stable. That's another matter. But in the model, in the function that you got, it's telling you that. And it doesn't matter about the correlations, but it sure matters about the interaction effects. And what I'm going to do is use the fact that it matters for the interaction effects to try and derive what the interaction effects are. Okay. So what is an interaction effect for those of you who haven't thought about it? We say a function of several variables, or many variables, doesn't matter, f of x, of many arguments, has an interaction between two of those arguments, say xj and xk. If the change of the function when we change one of them, say xj, depends on the value of xk, the other one. If it doesn't depend on the value of the other one, then there is no interaction between those two. If it does depend on it, there's an interaction effect. How strongly it depends upon the second variable is the strength of that interaction effect. Okay. Looking at this, you can see that this is a statement about the second derivatives of the function. Namely, if the second derivative of the function with respect to those two variables is everywhere zero, then there is no interaction between them. If it's not everywhere zero, there is an interaction effect between them. Okay, this I've defined it for numeric variables. You can make the definition for categorical variables using finite differences. Okay, so that's an interaction effect. Okay, whoops, wrong way. Okay, now, if there is no interaction between two variables, then you can write the function as a sum of two functions. One of the function does not depend on the first one, the other one does not depend on the second one. You can see this because if I take the derivative, second derivative with respect to j and k, when I take it with respect to j, it kills this one because this one doesn't depend on j, and it kills this one because it doesn't depend on k. If this is the case, then the partial dependence of the function on those two variables can be expressed as the sum of the single variable partial dependencies. So a measure of how strong these two variables are interacting is how different is the two-variable partial dependence plot from the sum of the singles. And how well does the sum of the single partial dependencies explain the two-variable partial dependence? And here I've written that down as just the fraction of variance explained. This gives a measure of strength of the interaction between those two variables. Okay? Now, if a particular variable interacts with no other variable, then the function itself can be written as a function of that variable alone plus a function of all the other variables. And in that case, we say that the contribution to that function, to this function, to the total, is additive or is a main effect. There's no interactions. Okay. If that's the case, then the function itself can be expressed as the partial dependence of the function on that variable plus the partial dependence on all the other variables. Okay, so a measure of how strong a particular variable is interacting with other variables without having to specify what the other variables are or what the nature of the interaction is, the order or nature, is simply the degree to which the function cannot be expressed or captured by its partial dependence on that variable plus its partial dependence on all the others. If it can't, and again I use just fraction of variance explained, if the function can be expressed in its partial dependence on that variable plus the partial dependence on the others, then that variable is not interacting with any other variable. If it's not, it is interacting. I don't know yet which variables it's interacting with or the degree of those interactions, a two-variable interaction, a three-variable interaction, or whatever. Okay. Finally, for completeness, we say that a function has a three-variable interaction between three variables, say x, j, x, k, and x, l, if the corresponding third derivative with respect to those three variables is not everywhere zero. Now, if there is no three-variable interaction between these variables, then we can write the function, decompose it into a function that does not depend on the first one, plus a function that does not depend on the second one, plus a function that does not depend on the third one. Now, just because there's no three-variable interaction between these three variables does not mean that there aren't two-variable interactions between their pairs. This is a statement about the third derivative. Two-variable interactions are statements about the second derivative. Okay? Now, it turns out, and this is a little harder to prove, that if there is no three-variable interaction between three chosen variables, okay, I can write the partial dependence of the function on those three variables as a sum of the corresponding two-variable partial dependencies minus the sum of the one-dimensional partial dependencies. So again, I can test for the existence of a three-variable interaction on three specified variables by simply constructing partial dependence plots and taking this combination. And if this combination explains the three-variable partial dependence, okay, then there is no three-variable interaction. If it doesn't, there is. Okay, so what's our strategy here? First thing we do after we build the model is we identify the important variables, which is often a small subset of all of them. Among each of those, we use our single-variable interaction statistic to identify which variables are interacting with others without having to identify what they are or the nature of the interaction. Okay, once we've identified those variables that are interacting, okay, we use our two-variable interaction statistic to ask which variables is it interacting with. So, for example, suppose this statistic said that X14, the 14th variable, is strongly interacting with other variables. Then I would look at the interaction strength of X14 with X1, X14 with X2, and in that way I can get what variables it's interacting with. Okay, and for those that are exhibiting two-variable interactions, I can then go ahead and check if I want the three-variable interactions. And then I can view the relevant partial dependence plots to get an idea of the nature of those interactions. And so that's what I'm going to do now. So here's an illustration. How am I doing on time? Well, it's getting late, but I think we'll make it. Okay. I ran here just the parameters of the procedure. I used a small value of the memory parameter, the fraction of observations at each step in the ensemble generation procedure grows as the square root of n. I used four terminal node trees. I built a little over 300 trees to make 2,000 rules, which were then subject, plus the linear terms. Okay, and the data set I'm going to illustrate with, you'll all laugh, is the good old Boston Housing data. I once promised never to use it again. The Boston Housing data is a classic data set that's used to test the predictive ability of models. It's one of the many classic ones that people use. We're going to use it here for a different purpose. We're going to use it to try and understand the nature of the predictive relationship in the Boston Housing data. Okay? For those of you who may not be familiar or don't remember, this data set consists of 506 neighborhoods in the Boston metropolitan area. In each neighborhood, there were 14 summary statistics were collected. Okay, the one of them is going to be the outcome variable. That is the median house value in the neighborhood. These are basically census tracts. And then the predictor variables will be the other attributes of the neighborhoods. And as we go along, I'll tell you what they are. Okay, running this rule fit procedure, generating 2,000 rules plus the linear term. After the last two regression, about 10% of them survived. So our model. In terms of prediction error, if you fit just a linear model, you get about 0.5, only relative. If you fit an additive model, no interactions, just main effects, it's 0.37, and the full model is 0.33. So it's clearly the relationship between housing price and the other variables is nonlinear, and there's some evidence for interactions. Okay, here are the most important rules. In other words, I said you can get the importance of each rule, rank them, and look at the most important. Here I'm looking at the six most important. Notice that the sixth one is only one-fifth as influential as the most important already. Okay? The first rule, the most important rule, is a linear term in the fraction of lower economic status people that live in the neighborhood. The coefficient is negative, meaning the more lower status economically in the neighborhood, the more lower economic status people live in the neighborhood, the lower the housing price, because this is negative. Here is the next most important is the linear term in age, so it's entering linear terms. The first rule that enters, which is very important, is a rule that says that the neighborhood is close to downtown Boston. This is a mistake. This should be less than. The pupil-teacher ratio is favorable, and the fraction of lower status people is less than 10% in the neighborhood. This rule only covers 1% of the data, but it has a huge coefficient. So those neighborhoods that for which this rule is satisfied get a big bump in their housing price. Okay, and here's some more rules. We're running low on time. I will. You can look at the rest of these. And for instance, this one says, if in your neighborhood the houses tend to be large, this is the number of rooms in the houses. And the pollution is low. This is the nitrous oxide concentration in the atmosphere. That tends to increase the value of the house because this coefficient is positive, and that rule covers around 23% of the data. Okay. Okay, here are the importances of the predictor variables. Can you read that? I guess you can. All right. This is the importance of the variables as averaged over all of the observations. So this is the average importance. And we see that the most important variable is the fraction of lower status people, economic status people that live in the neighborhood. Pupil-teacher ratio is important. Size of the houses is important. The pollution is important. Crime rate has some importance. Tax rate has some importance. And distance to downtown Boston has some importance. Okay? Now remember, this is averaged over all predictions. We can get the importance of the predictor variables for individual predictions. So I decided to predict the housing prices in Manchester, which is one of the 506 neighborhoods, and look at the importance there. And in Manchester, the thing that drives housing prices, or not housing values, is the size of the houses, apparently. And I've never been to Manchester in Boston, so I don't know what it's like, but apparently it's the size of the houses, fraction of lower status is important, education and tax rate are important too, but it's mainly the size of the houses that's driving it. Okay, here is the importance of the variables as averaged over the 10% of the neighborhoods with the lowest predicted housing value. In other words, if the model predicts a low housing price, what variables is it using to predict? And we see it's almost entirely using the fraction of lower economic status people in the neighborhood, using very little of the other. Okay, whereas here is the corresponding plot for the 10% of the neighborhoods with highest predicted housing value. And here you see it's the size of the houses, it's the quality of the education, it's pollution somewhat, and also fraction of lower status. But you see they're very different. That's an indication of interaction effects, that it's using different variables to predict low values than it is high values. All right, let's look at interaction effects. Okay, here is a plot of the single variable interaction statistic. The higher the bar, the more that variable, the stronger that variable is interacting with other variables. The red is the standard deviation of this statistic under the null hypothesis of no interactions. I don't have time to tell you how you get that, but it's in the paper. All right. So what we see here is that these variables seem to be interacting with other variables. Those five and the rest don't seem to be interacting much at all. I decided to pick the top two, the size of the number of rooms and the fraction of lower status. Okay, here is number of rooms. We see that there's strong evidence that the number of rooms are variable, strongly interacting with pollution and strongly interacting with quality of education. And for lower status, it seems to also be strongly interacting with pollution and interacting strongly with distance to downtown Boston. And no evidence that it's interacting with any other variable. Okay? So these are four. And then, of course, because these two are both interacting with nitrous oxide, you might say, well, that may represent a three-variable interaction. We can go test for that. I did. There isn't one. There is no three-variable interaction. This is just a pair of two-variable interactions. Okay, here is the partial dependence plots for those four interaction effects that we discovered. And time is almost out, so I'll only look at one of them, and that's this one here. This is the partial dependence of our predicting function on distance to downtown Boston and fraction of lower economic status that live in the neighborhood. And I've reversed the plot so that the high values are here and the low values are up here, so you can see it. And if we look at this, we see that as the fraction of lower status decreases, because that way it's decreasing, housing values tend to increase pretty much linearly until you get to very low values, and then you get a shot up. We see here that in terms of distance to downtown Boston, housing prices are pretty much independent of distance to downtown Boston until you get really close. But notice what happens when both are simultaneously very small. Huge spike if you are both close to downtown Boston and have a small fraction of lower economic status in the neighborhood, you get a huge spike in housing values. That's the interaction effect we were seeing between those two variables. The interaction effects here are apparent, but not quite as easily explained. Okay. I basically want to thank you very much. Future work, I'd like to work on more on the rule summarization. Okay, if you want a copy of these slides, it's at that URL. The aisle procedure is described in this paper, and I have to say that none of this would work unless there was a fast algorithm for getting the lasso solution. That's the bottleneck in the computation. Building the trees, extracting the rules is fast. But now we have this big problem with maybe 2,000 variables and who knows, 20, 50, 100,000 observations. And we've got to get a sequence of lasso solutions. Okay, that's kind of what inclined me to do the research that I talked about yesterday. But there's been huge progress in that. In fact, that's been a whole cottage industry, is fast algorithms for L1 regularized problems. And so without that work, this wouldn't be possible, because then it would be the doing the post-lasso regression would take too long. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.